We all want to make a positive difference in the lives of the people that we coach. And while we are fighting many external forces that are keeping us from making that possible, from making that impact a reality, it's likely that the internal forces, they sometimes provide actually some of the biggest resistance. That internal force and drive to win, it's a big part of that. So where do we start if we want to really take on that internal force, that internal resistance? Well, the key is self-awareness, and it's absolutely critical for us if we want to really live out our mission as a coach and to become the coach we want to become. Today on the podcast, we've got one of the best in the world at helping coaches to become more self-aware. Simon Turner is the founder of Movement Sports, and he asks hard questions and he helps us to face that reality, that very truth, that as coaches, we change lives and it isn't always for the better. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, brought to you by Thrive on Challenge. I'm JP Nurbin, joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week in about 30 minutes, we discuss important principles and strategies of transformational leadership. At Thrive on Challenge, we help coaches to raise the standards and strengthen the relationships in their program because we know this type of culture produces better leaders, better people, and better results. To learn more about how we can help you, go to thriveonchallenge.com, where you can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and get the coaching notes to every episode of this podcast. I am excited to have Simon Turner on the podcast today, someone that was recommended to me by Alan Keene, who's a frequent guest on the podcast and a good friend of mine and Nate's. And we're just really excited to have Simon here today to kind of explore some really deeper issues in sport. You've got a unique background, Simon, in how you came into this role as a social entrepreneur. And thought you could just start by just sharing a little bit of that background with our listeners.
Well, thanks, JP and Nate. It's a pleasure to be with you. And next time I see Alan, I'll definitely pass on my thanks to him as well. So, you know, we probably spend the rest of the podcast going back and forth on a fairly long backstory for me, but the short of it is I grew up in New Zealand, played basketball from the earliest age I can remember, and just like many of the listeners to your podcast, just fell in love with sport. And, you know, early on, I thought I loved sport. As I got older and looked back on it, I realized that what I really loved was two things. I love strategy. I'm just a strategy geek. I can watch any sport and my brain just goes to the strategy, the tactics of what's happening. And then as I got even older, I realized that I really valued the connections that sport gave me. So that's given me a kind of different perspective on sport. And that led me really to meander down this route of like, why do we take part in sport? Initially, why did I take part in sport? And then broader, like, why do all of us take part? What is it that drives us forward? Because I don't believe it's winning. I know that will drive a lot of people and it's a goal, but I kind of differentiate a goal from a driver. And I wonder if there's, you know, deeper reasons why we're involved in sport beyond just what we often talk about on the surface. So through my involvement in basketball, I went in numerous different directions. And I remember an experience when I was about 19, 20, 21. This would have been like early 2000s. I was supporting the local professional basketball team. So I was like the third string point guard on the National League second division team in my city. Well, there was a fourth string point guard, but he would probably argue that he was the third string point guard. So I had a good, you know, middling basketball career, but I was supporting the professional club and some of their communications and their marketing. And I started just really totally off my own back, really small basketball magazine. Started out writing the game program for this professional team, small professional team. We're talking New Zealand here. And I had this experience where there was a volunteer who led a lot of the basketball development in my city in Wellington, a lawyer And he was, you know, he had some money. He's not a millionaire, but well, who knows how much money he had. But, you know, he had a professional job. He earned his money. And he gave me a lift home from a meeting. We had a volunteer meeting one night. He gave me a lift home. And as I'm getting out the car, he passes me an envelope. I'm like, oh, right. You know, when people pass you envelopes, you know, you know, question marks immediately spring up. And then he drove off, and he was a lawyer, so he drove really fast. So like he just drove off, you know, really fast. And I open, and on the front of the envelope, it's written a contribution to your efforts. And I open it up, it's $250. And I'm like 20, 21. This is early 2000s. So that's probably worth, you know, this is like $5,000 to me, right? You know, an equivalent today money. And I was like totally taken aback, and it was my first introduction to the concept that I now know to be: people don't support what you do; they support why you do it. He was supporting me because I was making genuine entrepreneurial efforts to support the growth of basketball. The messaging and what I was writing was all about the team. It was all positive. It wasn't necessarily highlighting the stars. In fact, I went out of my way to highlight team players on this professional team, and to hopefully present quite a balanced approach. And that's stuck with me to this day. That person, Justin, is unfortunately no longer with us, but his story is very similar to, I think, what a lot of us experience, which is sport at the community level is really heavily influenced by a small number of people doing a large number of work and doing really incredible things. So from there, shortcut a few of the stories, and I find myself in the United Kingdom. I have a British passport. My family's English, Welsh, and Scottish. So I found myself in the United Kingdom and in Edinburgh in particular, and forged a career here as a coach, a volunteer coach in the first instance. Worked for the National Federation of Basketball Scotland as the player development manager. I had a short experience with British basketball in the lead up, or really the precursor to the lead up to the London Olympics, where I was involved in some of the very provisional conversations of how the player pathway and coach pathway should look moving forward. And then one day, a sports centre in my neighbourhood closed down, and I'd been losing money for a long time. And the local authority, the local government, finally shut it down. It just wasn't working financially. It was hemorrhaging money. And it's a pretty small sports center. It's a basketball court, full-size court, but no seating whatsoever. Dance studio, changing rooms, office. Really like a high school training gym in many countries of the world. And it lay dormant for a year. It was boarded up, there's graffiti on the windows, all that kind of stuff. And I sat around a kitchen table with a group of volunteers from the basketball club, and we took the plunge and we entered the procurement process to take over the building. We won that process. We set up a charity, and we set about kind of transforming a failed sports center into an asset for the community. And our original motivation was to grow basketball. It really was our original motivation. But as I progressed into it, I just realized, hold on, there's something way more at stake here than the growth of our basketball club. This is an asset sitting in a community who's very much on the border between two quite different communities. And so that led me down this social entrepreneur route. And when I started out, I didn't know I was a social entrepreneur. I've only been labeled as that in more recent times, but, you know, come to understand the value of sport to communities. In order for us to survive, we had to put in an ethos and a culture that was much more than just either participating in sport or performing in sport. It had to be much, much more than that in order for us to attract the kind of support, investment, volunteering that we would need to make that enterprise work. So fast forward 8 or 9 years, and we've got a fully sustainable charity that runs the sports center. It's no longer losing money. In fact, we generate a small surplus every year, which we reinvest back into the organization. And it's a thriving community enterprise with basketball coming out your ears. But we also set about changing the purpose of what we do. And we now focus on mental well-being as our core outcome. So whereas before you might have described the development of mental skills or mental well-being as being a byproduct of what we did, of being a kind of happy coincidence that comes alongside taking part in sport, now it's actually the reverse. Now it's very much the core intention behind what we do. And if our players progress on to other levels, which they do, that's the unintended byproduct. So we aim to kind of flip sport on its head and do things in kind of the opposite of the traditional approach.
There's so many things I want to unpack there. And one of those things I want to come back to is that idea of driver versus goal and the difference. But I think you finish at a place there and it leads us down a path that I really want to explore with you, which you talk about mental well-being as not a byproduct, but becoming the primary focus, and the byproduct being, if it happens to be so, player advancement and involvement. And that really ties with what you were saying earlier, where you were talking about even just your own coaching journey, which I think is so similar to mine and other coaches, that we get early on and as a coach, we're into the technical side of it. Then we like to get into maybe the tactical. And then for me, it was, I got to focus on the culture aspect because I understood the tactical and technical. Without the culture, it didn't work. But somewhere down that road of really investing in the culture, I came to certain realizations myself that still wasn't enough. You know, like high-performing culture, that, you know, my intention, my purpose, my why in coaching of using it to impact and positively impact other people, you know, you have to make that really the main focus, and you're be intentional about that if you want to be successful. So I think so much of your work around, especially through movement sports, you know, goes against this common assumption that people hold, which is that sport is good, you know, by inherently good. It's just going to, if people play sports, it's going to have a positive impact. And I could see many people, if I can keep this gym open and kids can come in here, it's going to positively impact their life. But that's not always the case. Can you explain a little bit about your rationale and your belief behind that?
Well, if you keep that gym open and there's a coaching culture within that gym of abuse, then you're doing harm to your community. And the first thing we have to do in sport, in my estimation, the first thing we have to do in sport is we have to acknowledge the harm that we do. And I'm not suggesting you do harm or I do harm or any of the coaches listening to this do harm, but collectively we need to own the culture within sport. And part of that is acknowledging that sport does do harm to people. So, for example, there's a study here in the United Kingdom done by the University of Edinburgh, one of the absolute top top research universities in the world. And that study interviewed 3,000 young people emerging. So they were late teenagers, early 20s. And it asked them about their experiences of childhood sport. 75% of those people said that they had experienced emotional harm while taking part in sport as a child. Now, that's not necessarily abuse. I don't mean child protection issues. I don't mean the worst end of the scale. I mean the middle and the other end of the scale. 75% of children experience emotional harm at some point while they take part in sport. And when I look back at my coaching career and all the young people I've coached and all the environments I've been a part of, I have to own that there's a reasonable likelihood that a large proportion of those kids had difficult or damaging experiences under a culture and an environment that I led. Might not have been 75% of them. I would like to think my culture was different. But even if my culture was much better than other sports cultures, it still wouldn't have gone from 75 down to zero. So I have to own that, and I have to understand that I'm the owner of the environment, that I set the context. So most of those negative experiences actually occur peer to peer. So it's not necessarily coach to participant, it's peer to peer. But we own the environment, we set the environment, and our actions and the way we carry ourselves have ripple effects right through a culture. And so the first thing we have to do is we really have to acknowledge that sport does do harm, and we have to take ownership of that. Even if you don't believe it's in your culture, it's still in sport, it's still in the broader, you know, sport culture.
What would you say the coach that's like, oh, I played sports and it's where I am today. It's who I, you know, why I'm the person I am today, you know, that don't necessarily kind of agree with that philosophy or that view, or even just some of that research out there.
Well, that coach and you and Nate and myself, we all have survivor bias, right? We all survived the sporting system and we benefited from that sports, that system. We were able to come through it. And then as we came through it, we were able to extract some learning from it. But what about the people that didn't come through that sporting system? What about the people that touched that sporting system, had a difficult experience, and then left it? So in sport, because we have so many internal conversations within our culture, I mean, we have so many conversations where we just talk to other sports people or other coaches, we actually miss the broader perspective that wider society has on sport. And especially now, every aspect of our society has to justify its contribution to society, its contribution to rebuilding our communities. And so one of the challenges we have is we're all, like us three, we don't need to convince each other that sport does good. You know, we've experienced that. That's not the challenge. The challenge is creating experiences for people that are on the fringes of the sporting system and that have had really negative experiences and not re-engaged.
Simon, when I hear that statistic, you know, I think back to a lot of the research in the States about the percentage of children that are quitting organized sport, you know, by the age of 12 and 13 is a very similar number. You know, they're talking about 70%, you know, attrition rate in organized sports across the board. And, you know, one of the things that I know has been a common theme in a lot of your work is the concept of putting people first. And I wonder, you know, when you're starting to work with coaches, is that where you begin to, I mean, there's an acknowledgement of the harm that coaches can do and have done, but when you're starting to educate others, do we start with people first rather than winning first or even player development first?
Yeah, great point, Nate. And if we take that statistic, there's a 70% attrition rate, that means that you and I and JP are in the 30%. So should we be having conversations inside the 30% and agreeing what the role of sport should be in our communities? Or should we be going and talking to the 70% who have been turned off by sport, who've left sport, and ask them what role sport could have played in their lives or should have played in their lives? So we're frequently preaching to the converted by having these kind of internal conversations inside of sport. And I like your suggestion there about putting people first. And when faced with two options, I either put winning before people or people before winning, it's a fairly obvious decision to put people first, but much, much harder to do in practice. But I would elevate, you asked me what would we work on first with coaches? Well, the first thing we work on is with coaches is nothing to do with the people you coach. It's to do with you. Who am I as a coach? That's ground zero for thinking about our philosophy. And then it extends to how I impact on others. And then it extends to how those others impact on the communities that they're a part of. And then it goes another ripple out of how those communities fit into a broader society. But we can't separate our own well-being, our own personal psychology from our coaching.
Well, as we go to ground zero as coaches, you know, we try to start to do that inner work. I think that's where we start to really investigate and, as you talked about earlier, the survivor bias, we start to realize that that has taken hold in ourselves as coaches. Like we coach the way that we were coached. And if we've had negative experiences in coaching, if we've had certain traumatic events through sports, then those can start to manifest in our own coaching. Do you ever unpack those with some of the coaches that you work with?
Yeah, really, really interesting. So I'm working with a focus group of coaches at the moment, and one of the absolute first question I asked them on the very first session was, take yourself right back to as far as you can remember to the moment that you fell in love with sports. What way, way back, as far back as you can go, what was the moment that you fell in love with sports? And when I ask that question, I frequently get answers like, my dad took me to a game, or watching my sibling play, or watching the excitement in my town when something happened. And they're often really closely associated with connection with others, especially our parents. And so the reason we fall in love with sport at the beginning isn't always the reason why we continue, or we lose that so easily. And then we go through these up and down experiences, like you described, where we have these great highs, but then we also have these really harmful experiences as well. And I wonder if there's something with coaches where we, not intentionally, but we've survived something, so it can't be that bad. But I've survived these tough times. When I was a player, the coach used to make me run. What I'm getting you guys to do is nothing compared to what my coach used to do to us. So if I survived it, you can survive it. Which, when you think about it, is a coach-centered approach to your coaching. It's about me. It's ground zero, as opposed to a person-centered or a participant-centered approach, which is to start with the needs of the people that you're coaching. So I'm really interested, JP, like, how did some of those negative experiences affect you? Like, we can tell ourselves a story about how they toughened us up, but is it really? Is that the whole picture?
Well, you talk about the whole picture, and I think you're starting to unpack some things with this here that really can kind of tie back to our why as a coach. I mean, I think if you ask most coaches, youth level, even collegiate level, heck, even some professional coaches, they coach because they want to make a difference, the difference in the lives of the people they coach. I think that would be the common answer. But I think you would agree with me that when you start to do this inner work, when you go back to ground zero, you start to uncover some of your own experiences, you realize that those things impact your own motivations. And that our why we coach, isn't just that simple of an answer.
You know, one of my rules of thumb and something I've learned, JP, is when I first ask a coach why they coach, is I don't believe their answer. I don't believe their first answer. And if I'm honest with you, JP, I don't believe your first answer either. Right? That's not to say that making a difference isn't part of your why. I acknowledge that. I can absolutely see that. But I think sometimes we distill it down too quickly and too easily. It's quite a North American thing to do, if you don't mind me saying, to try to narrow this down to like one reason, something I can remember, almost a strap line for why I coach. When actually, if you unpack that, that's only one of the reasons you coach. And if you think about it in terms of a psychological model, just something as basic as Maslow's hierarchy of needs, there's other needs that need to be taken care of before you can get to those higher levels of supporting others and making a difference for others. When I look back on my own journey, why did I pursue basketball? Why do I love basketball so much? I think as a young person, it was therapy for me. Being alone on a basketball court was essentially my kind of reflection time, my meditation. That's actually where I processed some of the difficulties of being a teenager, was me on a bit of the Larry Bird fantasy, you know, me on a basketball court with a ball, you know. And then as I got older, I in my context had some challenges with relationships when I was younger, and a team gave me relationships, gave me connections straight away. And then as I got into coaching, I think some of the early reasons why I was coaching was about self validation, was about trying to become significant in some way, trying to empower myself, trying to feel like a sense of progression, a feeling of control and empowerment. And those are much closer connected to the ground zero reasons why I coach. And then as I've got older again, become more self-aware, more secure, and those basic human needs become more catered for, now I'm more able to enter that kind of more enlightened thinking around, well, now my why is closer to making a difference for others. When, if I'm honest, right back at the beginning and through much of my early coaching career, the why was connected to helping others, but that was secondary. The primary why was much closer to developing my sense of identity and becoming a person of significance through coaching.
I mean, let me push on that a little bit from a North American perspective, because I think even JP and I are probably guilty in some of our trainings of really trying to drill down to the essential ideal, you know, in terms of what motivates us to coach and what drives our culture and our interactions with kids. And I wonder if you could, you know, in some ways, the way that you describe why you've coached over your career is almost like the investigation of a mystery. I mean, that's sort of how you're describing it, is I discovered this and I, you know, it was like that and it kind of evolved. And I don't know that, I mean, personally, I don't know that I've ever delved into my own, you know, sense of purpose or meaning in coaching to that degree. And I wonder, why does that matter? I mean, you've gone on that journey, you've taken other coaches on that journey. For us in North America that didn't even know that was a journey, why does that matter for coaches to get that in depth in terms of just exploring their motivations and their meaning?
Well, self-awareness has exponential benefits. Like, there's no aspect of your life that won't be improved as a result of increased self-awareness. So asking the right questions, or asking powerful questions, and then reflecting deeply on that, and then critically getting peer input into those questions, i.e. how other people see you, right? Assuming that you trust those people, so peers that are close to you, I think is an extremely valuable experience that'll impact the rest of your life. So it manifests itself in the decisions you make as a coach and the responses you have. I mean, I've heard you guys talk on your pod before about the role of an outcome focus, a focus on winning, on our behaviors as a coach. Do our anxieties go up as the game goes on and we get closer to the end, closer not just to the result, but closer to the moment of judgment, closer to the moment in which all the people watching will judge me as either being of worth or not of worth? And is it any wonder that coaches and indeed players lose their composure in those moments? Because we think it's about a blown referee call. I don't think it's when I see a coach like that, I don't think it's about a blown referee call. I think it's about that person's sense of worth and significance and identity being on the line. Sport is incredible in the way it exposes our character. And for me, it's been an amazing experience just putting myself in those kind of opportunities and then looking back and thinking about my response to to those moments. So when I look at a coach and I look at a player as well, and I see their behaviors, I see some of the tactical elements, of course. I see some of the strategic elements, of course. I see some of the relationship elements, of course. But it goes further to that. And if you can see how you're responding to this situation on a quite a deep psychological level, then I think you've got the basis for overcoming that. So instead of focusing on the level of behaviors, if we dig deeper and focus on the level of values and beliefs, and then even deeper focus on the level of identity, I think we get much closer to the kind of change that becomes transformational, which is, you know, what you guys talk about so often.
What you're talking about doing this inner work is so important, because like you said, if we don't do it, then how are we really going to get in there and change our behaviors? And I think it's just become a little bit of cliche, you know, some of the things that we do here out of coaches, you know, oh yeah, I'm here because I want to make a difference. It's all about the kids, you know, you get these, you know, big time coaches out that are saying that, and it's just really not always the case. There's a lot more to that. You know, I've written a book, and I think one of the most cliche things that people say when they write a book that I probably am guilty of is, if just one person reads this book and it makes a difference in their life, it's been worth it. It's totally not worth it. It's just, I'm sorry. I've got lots of emails from people that, oh, this book has totally impacted my life. And it's not like, oh, there we go. You know, like, you still check your book sales. You still push it. You still check your reviews. You're still looking for more recognition because it's something bigger than that. And I genuinely believe that anybody that's ever said that, they just really haven't done the inner work to explore, you know, their why behind things. I think you can do it to anything that we do within our life. And it's obviously kind of a deep philosophical type of approach to coaching. And just thinking about it for some of us coaches probably makes our head hurt. But yeah. I guess my question for you then is there any value in crafting our why into some sort of statement or these purpose statements that I've honestly have been so intentional about for the last few years? Or is it all rubbish, as they say in the UK?
No, it's not all rubbish or trash. It's neither rubbish nor trash. So there's enormous value in writing those kind of purpose statements if they are accompanied with self-reflection and input from people that you trust, that are close to you. Because what those statements will reveal, if you look at them in a lot of detail, is congruence with your values, your beliefs, and ultimately your identity. And if those purpose statements aren't aligned to those three things, our values, our beliefs, and identity, you will come unstuck. Like, identity wins every time. Your sense of identity is undefeated, right? It is what guides you. And sending out social signals about your identity is what drives us as people, in my experience. So I think that process is really valuable, JP. I would just encourage it to be embedded within a broader program of self-reflection and input from peers into that process.
All right, we'll be back next week with more with Simon Turner. Before we get out of here, though, I want to let you know about a unique opportunity to learn and grow as a coach this year. Myself and Alan Keene, who has been a guest on the podcast before, he actually made the introduction to Simon Turner. We have launched the Sideline Series. It's a weekly Zoom call where we are supporting each other as we apply transformational and athlete-centered coaching principles and strategies. You'll get an exclusive inside look into how we work through various challenges and even break down film of each other's coaching within practice and games. In the details of this episode, I'm going to include a link to one of our sessions that we've shared with the public on YouTube. Be sure to check it out. If it interests you, you can become a Sideline Series member. You'll not just get the video of all future sessions, but you can join us on Zoom, ask questions, and even get our notes from each session. To become a Sideline Series member, there will be another link as well in the details of this episode, or you can just shoot me an email at jpnerbun@thriveonchallenge.com.